Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This week, as we approach Juneteenth, we're going to be spending some time on our show digging into underreported stories from Black history. That's a pursuit our next guest has dedicated her life to. Dr. Rebecca Hall is a historian, an activist, and a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. When she was a PhD candidate, Rebecca became dedicated to telling the stories of enslaved women who had participated in or helped lead a slave revolt. Now Rebecca is presenting that history to the world in an innovative and moving format, a graphic book illustrated by Hugo Martinez. The title is Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts. The book is part memoir, part history, and part speculative historical fiction. Kirkus calls it, quote, an urgent, brilliant work of historical excavation. Dr. Rebecca Hall joins me now to discuss Wake. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Is it okay if I call you Rebecca? I should have asked first.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Okay. Rebecca, how do you define a slave revolt for so we have a sort of a baseline for everyone?
Yeah. So I define a slave revolt as a coordinated, multi-person act of violent resistance. Other scholars have other definitions, but this is the definition that I use because it's the definition, it's this understanding of revolt that seems to be the most problematic for that historians have the most trouble with in terms of seeing women involved in that.
What kind of activities are you describing, do you mean?
Well, you know, destroying property, killing slavers, doing that in the process of trying to escape or doing it as a process an act of revenge. Slave revolts were very common in the history of North America and the United States as well.
Why did you want to focus on the role of women in slave revolts?
Well, I was studying slavery, and I don't think it's a very good mental health formula to study slavery and not study slave resistance. And as I was studying slave resistance, I kept encountering histories written about slave revolt in particular that would sort of specifically deny women's involvement in revolts. It was almost like this mantra that kept getting repeated in every book and article I picked up on the topic of slave revolt. And I was curious about what would cause that, you know, that was sort of like, kind of like waving a red flag in front of a bull for me. It's like, really? Is that really true? And so I started looking at some of the primary sources of slave revolts and saw women all over the document.
My guest is Dr. Rebecca Hall. She's a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center in Harlem. We're talking about her book, Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts. In the book, when we first meet you in the book, it says, quote, I am a historian and I am haunted. What are you haunted by, Rebecca?
Well, I think, you know, slavery and its legacy. I think this whole country is haunted by slavery and its legacy, frankly. But for me, I think it's a little bit personal because my paternal grandparents were born slaves. Both of them were born in 1860, my grandmother on a plantation in Missouri and my grandfather on a plantation in Tennessee. That's kind of unusual. I'm 58. It's kind of unusual to have that, you know, to have, you know, grandparents be born human property, but the fact that it's even possible shows that this is not the distant past. And I think that I was in touch with and noticing, before I went back to school and got my PhD in history, I was an attorney and I was practicing law for about 8 years. And I kept noticing how certain systems and disparities kept appearing. And I felt it to me that there was a connection between what I was seeing and the legacy of slavery in terms of how African Americans are sort of viewed in our society and how we are compensated or not compensated and for certain harms and so forth. And so when I went back to study this, you know, I studied quite early in sort of the creation, the time period of the creation of racialized chattel slavery.
It's such an interesting format to tell such an important and serious and often, to your point, haunting history. When mm-hmm. did it become an idea, a thought that, you know what, let's make this a graphic book?
Yeah, I know. It's kind of strange. Like, I'm going to turn my dissertation and scholarly articles into a graphic book. I think, well, first of all, I've always loved graphic novels, especially ones that deal with history and like a real, I don't know if you've read the book Mouse, mm-hmm, My Father sure. Bleeds History by Art Spiegelman. Yeah. I think, so I've always been a fan of the genre, but there are things that you can do in graphic form that you can't do in other mediums. It's a kind of unique combination of like linear text and then all at once art, which allowed me to play with temporality. So, if you read the book, you'll see that the past is very much in the present, mm-hmm. in the art. And that would have been really hard to do in a regular book. And the other thing is that I wanted to get this history into the mainstream. I think some people feel like a graphic novel or comics treatment or whatever is a dumbing down of material. I really strongly disagree with that. I don't think it's a dumbing down of material at all, but it does increase access. So that's why I chose this approach. And then I had to find an artist because I can't even draw a stick figure.
And you found Hugo Martinez. What did you like about his style, his work? What did you hope that he would be able to help bring to the page?
Well, he works in traditional pen and ink, which is less common these days. A lot of people create this kind of art digitally. And I feel like the traditional drawing of ink on paper has a very different impact. I had seen some of his work, particularly in black and white, that I found very powerful. And I was very much wanting to do this work in black and white. I think there's something about black and white that is sort of very deep and powerful, mm-hmm. but it has to be done by the right artist.
My guest, Dr. Becca Hall. We're talking about her graphic book / memoir, Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts. So the first slave revolt you discuss happened here in New York City in 1712. What do we mm-hmm. know about the circumstances of that revolt and who was involved?
Yeah. So what we know about that revolt is primarily from colonial government records and articles in the newspaper, the Boston Weekly Newsletter, which was actually the only extant newspaper in the 1700s in North America. What we know, according to colonial governor Robert Hunter, in his correspondence with Queen Anne's Privy Council and the Lords of Trade, I mean, this New York is part of the British Empire at mm-hmm. this point. He describes the revolt that occurs in April in 1712, where enslaved people set a building on fire in what was then the East Ward, which is the very Lower East Side now. and as white people approached the building to put it out, they started to kill, they started shooting and killing the white people as they approached. The issue of fire was very scary and problematic in colonial times. So it was definitely a way to get attention quickly. And then some of these enslaved people left, you know, managed to escape, and many others were captured, tried, and executed.
You know, once you've reached the limit of historical record on some of these cases, you call for, quote, a measured use of historical imagination. And then there are some fictionalized and imagined storylines. Tell me a little bit about the parameters you put for yourself and how you wanted to make sure this was truly effective and gets to the point, and then rather than someone saying like, oh, that's made up, that's not real.
Exactly. Yeah. So the first thing is I really signposted. It was very important for me for people to know this part of this book is fiction. And of the 10 chapters of the book, there's like a chapter and a half that is fiction. But I call it a measured use of historical imagination because every aspect of the story that I tell in this so-called fiction section is grounded in very granular historical research. What I couldn't find in the record was the life stories of the women who were involved and convicted in this revolt. And so that's the part that where I tried to imagine, you know, who they were, what they cared about, what motivated them. But, you know, I know who owned them, what kind of work they did, you know, what it was like to work in a rope factory in 1712, you know, what the buildings were like, what plants were there. And even, you know, there's a section where there's an oathing ceremony where the enslaved people meet around a well and swear to each other to secrecy and invoke some spiritual powers leading into this revolt. The Governor Hunter talks about this this process of tying them each other to secrecy. I looked at a lot of revolts in the English Empire, slave revolts, like, for example, Tacky's revolt in Jamaica, where this enslaved oathing process is described in great detail. And I used that information to recreate this oath in New York City. So that's what I mean by a measured use of historical imagination.
There's another slave revolt you tell us about from New York City in 1708 that led to the creation of a law called an Act for Preventing the Conspiracy of Slaves. Would you mind reading from the document we have? It was written by somebody named Cornbury, describing what happened?
Yeah. So this was, at that time, in 1708, Lord Cornbury was the colonial governor of New York. So he's writing to the Lords of Trade. And he says, I have nothing new to acquaint you with, only that a most barbarous murder has been committed upon the family of one Hallett by an Indian man slave and a Negro woman who have murdered their master, mistress, and five children. The slaves were taken, and I immediately issued a special commission for the trial of them, which was done, and the man sentenced to be hanged and the woman burnt, and they have been executed. They discovered two other Negroes, their accomplices, who have been tried, condemned, and executed. I am, my lord, your lordship's most faithful and humble servant, Cornbury.
Now, from your own research, what were you able to find out what happened, about what happened?
Yeah, this was a tricky one. The documents I was able to find were like the document that I just read, so in government correspondence, and also the revolt was described in the newspaper, and I did some pretty extensive research on the family that was killed, where they were located, their backgrounds, what their property was, which I was able to obtain through a st- estate and probate records that are still on file in Queens. This revolt occurred in what is now Queens. At the time, it was called Newtown, but it's actually Elmhurst, Queens now. I was unfortunately never able to find the court record of the trial, like I was able to with the 1712 revolt. Finding the court records, the court sort of criminal trial proceedings, are really important in trying to tell a story of the agency of enslaved people and their role in slave revolt. And I was unable to find the trial, that record that the governor Cornberry refers to in his letter to the Lords of Trade. So I was never able to find out who these other two enslaved people were. And I was never able to find the name of the woman who was attributed with being the leader of this uprising.
Now, we've just talked about two slave revolts, one in Elmhurst, Queens, what is now Elmhurst, Queens, and one in the Lower East Side, both here in New York City. So what is not taught about the history of slavery in New York City? Because I think if you talk to the average person, they would think it wasn't that prevalent in the city.
What's not taught about it?
Yeah, that needs to be.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Yeah, New York City, people aren't really taught about slavery. The way slavery is taught generally in this country is very poor. And I think when people are taught slavery or think of slavery, they have this antebellum, southern plantation idea. But there was slavery from the very beginning of this of what would become the United States. And it was all throughout the North. And slavery wasn't just a rural phenomenon. It was very much an urban one. And so understanding the roots of New York City and how it was built and grew and became a financial force to be reckoned with is deeply embedded in the role of the city as a slave-holding city, a slave-trading city, and the financial, all the various financial aspects of being involved with slavery, everything from importing and exporting goods to ensuring, property in people. The slave market in New York City. When I originally did this research, there was no indication of where this was in the actual landscape. But from the documents, I paced it off and found, it was on the corner right here of Wall Street and Water.
Yeah.
And now there's a tiny little plaque.
Yeah.
I think they need to do more than that. Actually, enslaved people built Wall Street. Wall Street was named because there was a wall there. And they built, helped build Trinity Church, but they weren't allowed to be buried there. They had to be buried in the African burial grounds, there is a national monument here in New York for that.
It still amazing.
So that's why I focus on New York.
One of the things that I'm always amazed when I'm down in Wall Street towards, and I know where that plaque is, that people do leave flowers. I spent a lot of time down there for a bit, and the people have it has been discovered. So that's a good thing. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, my guess is Dr. Rebecca Hall, the name of the book is Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts, is that you talk about revolts on slave ships before people even got here. And there's this amazing moment in the book, I don't want to give too much away, when you discover enslaved people were insured under a policy called insurrection of cargo, and you try to go look at this at Lloyd's of London. But there's this incredible statistic that determined by quantitative historians, you found that in their study of 36,000 slave ship voyages, the more women there were aboard, the more likely a revolt.
Exactly.
What conclusions did historians draw from this? And then what conclusions did you draw?
Well, the historians who did this research and found that there were documented revolts on 1 in 10 slave ships and found that this was the only statistically significant thing. The difference was the more women on a ship, the more likely to be a revolt. immediately dismissed their own findings and said, you know, but we know that women were involved in this type of, you know, violent coordinated acts of resistance, so this must be some kind of fluke. But my response to that was to look at the actual captain's ship's logs that documented, exhaustively documented, these voyages, and also the business practices related to the British slave trade, because this was a business. And the way the ships were operated was that once a slave ship left the coast of Africa, women would be brought, would be unchained and brought on deck. So they had much greater mobility and were also close to the weapons. And so as I was reading, for months, these slave ship captains' logs and slave ship surgeons' logs, I saw, you know, descriptions of women's involvement in starting, instigating, leading revolts. So I think that explains why that was.
The name of the book is Wake, The Hidden History of Women-Led Slave Revolts. It is by Dr. Rebecca Hall, a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center in Harlem. Dr. Hall, thank you for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.